And this requires that Matthew 27:5 be read, he was hanged or strangled instead of he hanged himself.
So John Lightfoot, with some sort of strange reference to Tobit, which is about, the reference to Tobit would be about an evil spirit that strangles, is suggesting that what really happened was not that he hung himself, but the devil strangled him, or hung him, and threw him around and split him open. It gets a little bit more difficult even yet, because we can ask, was he repentant? That's irrelevant. We'll skip that one. Was he repentant? We'll go to where did he die? We already saw this. Acts says field of blood. Matthew doesn't say. So not a discrepancy. The location is not a discrepancy. Number 7, who bought the field of blood? Now this is a problem. Okay? So we already learned from Acts that Judas bought the field with the money that he made on the betrayal, right? Yeah. But if we go to Matthew 27, go back, I should say, to Matthew 27, we'll find that on the contrary, he doesn't have that money anymore.
No, he's throwing it away.
That's right. Matthew 27, verse 7. Well, this is after he's already thrown it away. So he throws it away. And then it says, the chief priest took the pieces of silver and said, it's not lawful for them to put into the temple treasury since it is the price of blood. And they conferred together with the money. And with the money, they bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood, as it is to this day. Does it say they buried him there? I always assume they buried him there, but it doesn't seem to say that here in Matthew. But I always assume that he was buried in this field. Mm-hmm. That his tomb was in this field. It is a burial place. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Did no one else ever assume that?
I did. Yeah,
that's true.
Huh?
I assumed he was.
Yeah? Okay. So at least I'm not alone in the assumption. Well, I just assume...
You know, in a way, you say Judas bought it.
Yeah, you could say he bought the field. So we can harmonize these narratives, and there's a couple different ways that you're all suggesting, and I could suggest as well, and I think we should harmonize the narratives. But to step back from that for a second, we do see that there are two different traditions, although closely related here. On the one hand, the money is given back to the priesthood or thrown back to the priesthood. Then Judas hangs himself or gets hung. Then the priesthood uses the money to buy the field. On the other hand, Judas uses the money. He doesn't give it back. He uses the money to buy the field himself, and he dies in the field. So there are two different strands of tradition here. What's sure is there is a connection with a bribe price of 30 pieces of silver or some amount of silver that Judas was paid, and that somehow this money is connected with the purchase of a field that's called the field of blood that then carries an association in apostolic tradition with Judas thereafter. So that's what we can, based upon the discrepancy, we can at least say they agree on this much, right? Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, as I've said before, I am all for harmonizing. That's all the sages did all the time, every day. You know, that's what Judaism really is harmonizing disparate religious texts, I think. That's a big chunk of it. So I'm good with that. But just as long as we understand, he's got a point on us here. Well, yes, that if all four Gospels had exactly the same story, we'd only need one. From my perspective, the reliability of the Gospels is heightened by their discrepancies, not because, well, that just shows that different people wrote them, but here's why I think it heightens their reliability, because it shows that the church didn't redact them.
Yeah,
that the early church fathers, the church in transmitting these gospels, transmitted them with all of their incongruities mm-hmm. intact. And so to me, that raises the credibility of the gospel narratives as we've received them. Mm-hmm. That's it for his list of reasons, but there's one more that he gives here, and that is the 30 pieces of silver. So look here in Matthew 27. This is very interesting, I think. This is the thing I was looking forward to thinking about with you. Matthew 27, beginning in verse 7, as we drop into this story again, it says, "The priests conferred together with the money they bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field, as the Lord directed me." Now Jesus stood before... Okay, so that's it. Okay, so great. Here's the problem. If we go and look this passage up in Jeremiah, which is Jeremiah 32, I just happened to have been working on this about 2 weeks ago, Jeremiah 32, in connection with a...
Chapter 32 or chapter 30, verse 2?
32. Chapter 32. This is a passage that actually shows up as a Haftarah in the reading cycle. I believe it was for Behar or Behukotai, but I'm thinking it was for Behar. And it's where Jeremiah's cousin comes and, or nephew, or cousin, or I think it's a cousin, comes and says to him, "I want you to redeem the field. My field at Anatot." And Jeremiah is like, the city is under siege, and in about, oh, you know, 1 week, there's going to be no kingdom of Judah, no land deeds, nobody's going to own anything, everything's going to be owned by Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar, and everybody's going to be deported. And Jeremiah knows this because he's been prophesying this for a long time. But even as his cousin is saying, "I'd like you to redeem this," you know, the battering rams were already hitting the walls. It tells us that the siege ramps were complete. So it's a little ridiculous of a request. It's like, you know, it's like, "And now how much would you pay?" You know? But the Lord tells Jeremiah, "No, do it. Buy it and pay full price, because fields and vineyards will again be sold in Judah." And he has him record it. You know, the story, puts it in a scroll. He seals it, preserves it for posterity by preserving the scroll in an earthenware jar. All right, so that's the passage where we're buying a field. But the field, if you start reading in verse 6, right? Jeremiah said, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'Behold, Hanamel the son of Shallum, your uncle, is coming to you, saying, buy for yourself my field which is at Anatot, for you have the right of redemption to buy it.' Then Hanamel my uncle's son came to me in the court of the guard according to the word of the Lord and said to me, 'Buy my field, please,'" etc. So I bought the field that was at Anatot from Hanamel, my uncle's son, and I weighed out the silver for him, 17 shekels of silver. I signed and sealed the deed." So, 17 shekels of silver. He buys the field. So, Asher Norman says, how does that fulfill the prophecy? 30 shekels of silver, they buy a field. Jeremiah buys a totally different field that's not even called the field of the potter, for 17 shekels of silver. But this is one case in which we managed to trick Asher Norman by slipping in the name Jeremiah when we really meant Zechariah. So here's the real prophecy that Matthew is referring to. If you turn over to Zechariah chapter 11, come over to Zechariah 11. We'll start in verse 11. So it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages, or as my price, you might say. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I threw the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. What do you think? Zechariah or Jeremiah?
In Matthew it says Jeremiah.
It says Jeremiah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So, what do you do with this? Well, I would say this is a situation where we can definitely be certain that Matthew really meant Zechariah. Mm-hmm. There's a few attempts to salvage at this point. There's a few attempts. One, I'll just run through them as they pop into my head. One is that there is an apocryphal version of Jeremiah or some other version of Jeremiah that we don't know about that also had a potter's field being bought for 30 shekels or something like that. That doesn't work so well. Another possible explanation is that Matthew was referring to a collection, some orderings of the Tanakh, the collection of the whole books of the prophets, Nevi'im, began with Jeremiah instead of Isaiah, apparently. Therefore, to say Jeremiah, you might be just using it to mean the prophets. I don't think so, because he's never done that at any other place. No, you know, this would be the only instance that we ever know of. Another possible save is that there was some kind of collection, conglomeration of prophetic texts that spoke, that the early believers used, that they had seen fulfilled in by Messiah, and that these two texts were married. This text from Jeremiah and the text from Zechariah were married together. Now this is very likely, because if this is the same thing that we see throughout the Midrash, is that there will be one text married to another text, and so, you know, things that are really talking about quite different things in their native context are taken out of context and joined to make a new thing. That's a normal Jewish kind of method of interpretation. So according to that, following that reasoning, what Matthew has done here, he's worked out a midrash with Zechariah and Jeremiah, taking these two passages, joining them, but he only mentions Jeremiah. So there you go. Anyway, it's a problem. Yes? Or maybe Matthew's early scribes made a mistake. You know, it's very possible that, and this is perhaps the most likely, is that you're an early generation of scribe. Most likely, I would say Matthew did not even give a reference. He said, happened to fulfill what was written in the prophets, saying, and then he kind of like quotes it, and a scribe is going to want to supply that name to bring it a little closer to home. And he's going to hear that potter's field. And where's his mind going to go? Jeremiah. Because Jeremiah is the guy who's like, goes up to the potter's house, and God's like, take a look at how the potter makes his pot. You know that whole thing?
Yeah.
Right. So his mind goes to Jeremiah. And then there's the field. His mind goes to Jeremiah. And so he's like, as Jeremiah the prophet, but it's Zechariah. Yeah. Anyway, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So, what's his conclusion? Asher Norman says, well, the devil's in the details. There are significant contradictions in the Gospel of Judas stories, and this undermines the credibility. I would say there are some contradictions. I'd say we found maybe two contradictions out of the eight or so that he listed, that there are two legitimate contradictions. Even these can be reconciled. And even these have a commonality of agreement between them. so that you could say they agree on more than they disagree on. So does it undermine their credibility? A little bit, in some ways, but in other ways, no.
Well, does it actually undermine their credibility if, as you've referred, that Judaism itself is a dynamic of marrying texts and such like that?
Sure.
I mean, then he would be damning his own...
Well, yes, but we're not turning the... Asher Norman does not have the critical eye focused right now on his own religious text. But yes, that's the principle that the guys at FFOZ and I always call it equal weights and measures. Because this always happens where people start to lose faith in Messiah and they'll start pointing these things out. You know, there's this, and did you know the gospel's this and that sort of thing. And they're like getting all twisted up over this stuff. And then so we always say, well, you know, are you applying the same standard to the Talmud? Are you applying the same standard to the Tanakh? And they never are. And they're never willing to do that. Reason number 21. The Jewish trial of Jesus lacks credibility. All right. First thing is, according to John, if we just start in the Gospel of John, there was no Jewish trial. And here's how he's going to bring us to the Gospel of John and chapter 18. We were just there a little bit ago, weren't we? Verse 13. 18, verse 13. The Romans led him to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now, Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. And so Simon follows Jesus, and so is another disciple. And now that disciple is known to the high priest. He entered into the court of the high priest. Okay, so what's going on? How far were we supposed to read? 13 and 14. Well, his point is just that... Oh, I see. His point is that this is not a trial. He's like brought to someone's house. And in fact, we'll see that's exactly the case. He's brought to the high... Annas there is like the godfather of the mafia of this priesthood, of the current priesthood to which Caiaphas belongs. Caiaphas is married to his daughter or something like that. And so Caiaphas is high priest on his father-in-law's dime. And so Jesus is arrested. He's brought to this guy's house. And then he's brought over to Caiaphas's house, because we find him in Caiaphas's house in the Synoptic Gospels. That makes sense. He's brought over here. He's brought over here. But the point is that these trials that we read about, that, you know, Jesus goes on trial, they aren't in a court. They're in someone's house. So this is it's not really a trial. And his point is that verse 24. So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas after questioning him. Right. Right now he's just staying with the John narrative. It says in verse 19, though, the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Mm-hmm. Why do you question me? And you have Peter standing in the courtyard and so on. All right, so that's about all you get from John. You don't get the details of the trial, what was going on. You don't get the details of the interrogation. Okay, so Matthew and Mark describe a Jewish trial with a blasphemy verdict. Let's look at the Mark version, I suppose. Mark chapter 14. They led Jesus away to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes gathered together. Peter had followed him at a distance. In verse 55, the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death. They're not finding any. For many were giving false testimony against him, but their testimony was not consistent. Some stood up and began to give false testimony against him, saying, "We have heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another.'" made without hands. Not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. The high priest stood up and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, "Do you not answer? What is it these men are testifying?" But he kept silent and did not answer. Again the high priest questioned him, saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Tearing his clothes, the high priest said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard blasphemy. How does it seem to you?" And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. All right, there you go. Here's a very interesting thing. The high priest, he won't answer any questions. The master doesn't answer any questions, right? And then it says he asks him again, and he answers. What's the difference? Why did he not answer, and then he did answer? The difference is, in Matthew 27:63, you read, Jesus kept silent, and the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us." So he puts him under oath, so to speak. He charges him in the name of God. In the Torah it says that if a person is charged to testify like this, and he does not, he will become guilty. And so he had no choice when he charged him like that to answer the question. Interesting item. Anyway, Asher Norman does a fairly good job of critiquing this narrative. I think I actually have in Torah Club at some point a critique as well of the trial that points out all the problems. The problems come down to this. We don't really need to go through all of these, and most of these turned out to be bum references anyway. I was just looking them up before the class. First of all, claiming to be Christ is not blasphemy, right? Claiming to be the Messiah. That's not blasphemy. Anybody could claim to be the Messiah. You don't get crucified for it. You know, you don't get stoned or something. It's not blasphemous to say, "I'm the Messiah." It's like, okay, great, dude, you know. Why don't you redeem us, Mr. Messiah guy? Okay, great. So that's not blasphemy. And so he says, that doesn't make sense. Claiming to be the Christ was a claim to the throne of King David. It was a claim of kingship, not godship, and was sedition under Roman law. Jesus was tried and convicted for claiming kingship, for sedition, and for telling Jews not to pay Roman taxes. So this is his theory. It's just a theory.